Kalimera, Kalispera, and welcome. My name is Jeremy Thomas. I'm the host and creator of How to Stay Sane in an Insane World. And we've been doing this now for about 4 years, originally under the fantastic name of Shed Talks, but we decided to change that. Our aim has always been to find interesting, entertaining guests from the worlds of film, TV, music, sport, French polishing, deep sea diving, whatever. Sometimes well known, sometimes not, but always people who are willing to talk honestly about their mental health. How things went wrong, what happened, how they became right, all the things that helped them stay right. And we use a dashboard of dials that you'll see to interact with guests and to see what they think about and how they judge things. Having made 23 episodes in a conventional podcast way, we decided it was time to get a bigger boat, expand into the live arena, and what better place to do that than the Riverside Studios in groovy West London, right next to the river. Now, we're about to go into that building and into the cinema. It's all very exciting. But first, let me tell you a little bit about the guest we have tonight, Carol Morley. Carol Morley is an award-winning maverick film director of 9 short films, 6 feature films, including The Alcohol Years, Dreams of a Life, Typist, Artist, Pirate King. She's worked with Toby Jones, Florence Pugh, Maisie Williams, Monica Dolan. Carol Morley is not somebody you could ever accuse of lacking in resilience, courage, or bravery. Despite a terrible, and I mean terrible, childhood tragedy, she has survived. She has lived life full on in Technicolor. She's a rebel, she's groovy, and she takes on topics other people would be frightened of taking on. Let's meet her right now.
Very good.
I'm going to start by just saying that, you know, what we did with the podcast is I did a lot of research on all the guests, which was great, actually. It made me read and read and read and read. And some of the books you can see here were absolutely amazing, really, really good to read. However, there was another book that was even more good, and that was written by this person on this photograph, and this was it, 7 Miles Out. You know, it's very easy to say, you know, all the sort of superlatives and all that sort of stuff. This book was written as a sort of novel, thinly written as a novel, in my opinion. It was really, I think, a memoir, but an amazing memoir. And I once, somebody once said to me, and I have written a couple of books in my time, somebody once said to me, oh, Jeremy, you know, the book you've written, I mean, I'm sorry. It's like viewing a train carriage window, you know, looking through a train carriage window from the outside, wishing you were on the inside. And I went, oh, really? And they went, yeah, see ya. And I thought to myself, when I read Carol's book, it's like being on the inside of a carriage with your arm round her and a bacon sandwich, and you're really enjoying it. And I loved it. I loved this book. And if there are any film directors apart from you here, you should read this book, because it'll make a cracking TV series or thing. I just loved it. And, you know, I can go on and on and on about it. One of the funny things I thought about it was that, funnily enough, I've never been a 13, 14-year-old girl. But when I read that, you know, it's written from that perspective. Yeah. It's very, if you're a bloke, it's quite interesting to get that angle, particularly bearing in mind what happened. But we'll come back to that in a minute. So now what we're doing is we're going to the title of this podcast, yeah. And then what we're doing is we're going to your favourite dashboard.
Oh yeah, I did look at it. I have to look up it. It's too small.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, basically,
To explain it.
Well, very quickly, for 10 years I've given a lot of talks to schools and companies about mental health, how to stay sane in the same world. Funnily enough.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, well, it's quite hard for some people to grasp what mental health is, you know. And it was much easier to sort of visualize it and have little dials where you go, right, it's 1 to 10. It could be, you know, if I had the money, and in fact, you could give me the money, Paul. Let's face facts. You could give me the money.
No.
If I had the money.
I would if I had it.
I would go to Disney and animate this because it would be great. So that you, if you suddenly say you're in your sleep, actually goes from 10 to 2. What else does that affect? What other dials does this affect? And it's basically the idea of this is that if you, you know, instead of having all sorts of fancy things, if you just have this, and maybe you have a mate, you know, and you go, right, should we, let's do the dials twice a week and see where we are and what we're supposed to, what we're supposed to do. And I include, you know, sense of humor. I think that's, you know, pretty important. And stress is very, 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 very important. And stress includes, I always say stress has a wicked stepmother, which is called trauma. Yeah. And trauma is when, you know, when we lose somebody we love, when we get divorced, when we bust up, when we move house, when the dog dies and when someone's sexually assaulted, whatever. But it's trauma untreated normally ends up in mental illness. And therefore my message, and it's nothing to do with it because this is for you, this is what I want to talk to you about, is that, you know, prevention is better than cure. So if you keep yourself in relatively good shape, when something shite awful happens, it will still hurt and you'll still be knocked backwards, but you will be able to cope if you've, you know, got your dials going. So you are somebody who, what's his name, Mr. Commode, the film critic, Mark Commode. He said of you that you can always get the surreal out of the real. And I think that's real. And I just think you've got a great eye altogether.
I think it's because I live the surreal. I don't see it as any different than the reality that we all inhabit. So I think I just... my everyday life is surreal. I don't think I try and manufacture it.
Yes, yeah. Well, but you do go for interesting topics, I think, in terms of films. And what we've done, we've got a few film clips, and I just want to play this one because I think it's shocking, but it's compelling at the same time.
Hello, it's Carol Morley phoning Joyce. I'm looking for any information, no matter how minor, about Joyce Vincent.
The reporters always get asked, oh yeah, what's the best story you've ever done or the worst story? And this is in my clutch of ones that you will just remember through a lifetime.
Mr. Vincent, we have a repossession order!
We knew pretty quickly that it was out of the ordinary.
She wasn't alcoholic, she didn't smoke, she didn't take drugs.
Miss Vincent! Miss Vincent!
They said she died around December 2003.
The only way she could be identified was by comparing dental records.
It was so horrendous. She was found in front of her television that was still on for so many years.
3 years and nobody's come looking for you.
You have this mystery that's suddenly thrown up and you just want to know more.
You know, if you had to meet Aretha Franklin, you know this woman's a star. You know, that's certain something. Joyce had that.
She had a very good voice.
People would gravitate towards her.
Very exotic, beautiful. Everybody fancied her.
Everything about her was immaculate. She just reminded me of somebody that I would like to be.
People said she looked like Whitney Houston. I thought she was more attractive than that.
Gosh, I mean, really... what do you feel now about that?
I'm really, really glad I made it because it was really difficult to make. Joyce died in 2003. Obviously, she was in her flat for 3 years above Wood Green Shopping Centre. So the story emerged in 2006 and the film took about 5 years to make. So it's about 14 years old now, but people still talk about it. And younger people are coming up to me who have watched it and relate to it. So it feels like this inevitable, it will have an inevitable life that unfortunately Joyce didn't get. And my original thought, which it was just a thought when I first saw the newspaper, which is in here, a skeleton of Joyce found, you know, with TV still on a couch. When I first saw that, I thought it was on the tube, and I just picked up the Sun and I thought, I'm going to make a film about you, even if I don't find anything out about you, because you deserve to have some sort of legacy. You can't be forgotten like this. And then, you know, the actual research took some time, and finding the people that knew her, because it was before social media. And so there wasn't this, that's why in the Sun there was no photo of Joyce, because it was just of her apartment, because no one was posting pictures of themselves happy at a party or drunk at a party. So that the press never got hold of a photo. And so I just began researching in lots of different ways, electoral records of all sorts of ways of, I put adverts out on the internet and in newspapers, and then slowly gathering the people that knew her. So Joyce became a person. It might not have actually, the film might not be the Joyce that truly existed, but it's definitely a portrait of Joyce through the people that knew her. And that to me was what was so crucial to that she didn't go forgotten. And I'm really happy that I made that film.
Sort of honouring her, really. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And Kyra Cannon and my producer and I, we went through all these incredibly ridiculous meetings and where people didn't want to finance it, which is pretty much the story of my filmmaking career. Somebody that turned it down once, somebody worked there, and when it was finally finished and shown at the London Film Festival, the person that worked there came out and said, everyone I work with, because they all turned it down, everyone I work with is going to get an email tomorrow and it's going to say, you are all effing C's. Yes. And I thought she wouldn't do it, but she did, because I heard from some of those people. And that was just sort of a victory moment. So I feel like for me, often what I want to make isn't necessarily seen as being wanted by an audience, but Dreams of Life has proven that this story that seemed very grim to people and unnecessary to tell, it never got in the major newspapers beyond the Sun just printing that, it was a very important story of our times, and that wasn't me being important. It was just sort of recognizing some importance in what had happened in a very, very busy part of London. And it seemed to me that Joyce was absolutely emblematic of an age, and she was born in 1965 when the post office tower went up, BT Tower, which was like the centre of communications, and she died with her television on, and she was so isolated within that. And so for me it was such an important story to tell about her. So yeah, so I'll always be happy that me and my collaborators made it happen.
Yeah, no, I get that.
And Zowie Ashton played her and brought her to life.
Yeah. Just one question about that. I haven't seen it for some time.
Yeah.
What was her family situation?
So in terms of the family, it took me a while to find them, but I did find them, and I did meet them. Almost all the, she had four sisters, and I met some of them. And they were, you know, I really got on with them, some of them. But unfortunately, because of society's kind of prejudices and very instantaneous ways of sort of kind of going to dislike someone or demonize someone because, you know, Joyce died alone and they didn't know where she was, they didn't want to be on camera. And I really respected them for that. And then I realized actually it was more freeing for me and possibly for the audience if it became a film about friendship and about the connections we make in life. And actually, once you leave home, family is obviously important, but it's not the only thing, and we make our own families. And the reason the family didn't know, really, I mean, it's a very complicated and long story, which is quite private, but one of the reasons they didn't know is they just thought she'd gone off to have a better life and had left them behind, and that's how they sort of read the situation.
Oh, right, that she was a bit ritzy. Yeah.
And that happened with all the friends. They just assumed Joyce was with Quincy Jones, she was in America, she was somewhere else, and she'd forgotten them. Yep. But in fact, that wasn't the case.
Right, okay, let's move on. And talk about you and talk about
my least favourite thing, believe it or not.
I'm sorry about that. Being brought up in Stockport,
yeah.
7 miles out of Manchester.
I was there recently.
And here are some, you know, wonderful pictures, and there's Strawberries Studios, etc.
I've seen them all.
And here's a picture of your mum and dad.
Yeah. And my sister Jane, and that's me in the red trousers.
That's very
all looking
nice.
Very happy. We've got the only pictures we've got, we all look pretty miserable. You're like, could we not smile for a photograph? Did we not get the memo? But yeah.
So it's Mum Angela, Dad Leslie.
That's Dillis, Welch, Dillis, Leslie, me, and Jane.
Right.
With a Y.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very nice. Okay. And this is you.
That's me. I was actually with my friend Colette there, but I cut her out because I didn't know if she'd want to be shown. But that's me at 10.
Right. Okay.
And that is basically the photos most of us have are those photos in a photo booth. Because we didn't take photos then, did we? Or selfies or, you know.
No.
This would have been the 70s.
Yeah. Well, you know, now we get to the sort of the bit where, you know, in your book, it's really, really poignant. And when you talk about your dad.
Yeah.
And he was a very nice chap, apparently, and from Margate, is that right?
He was born in Margate, and he met my mum when he was 19, so they had their first child, Paul, when they were both 19. And he moved to Stockport, which he really hated. I don't blame him. Sorry if anyone's from Stockport, but it's weird. But anyway, but he moved to Stockport. I remember his mum, my grandma, just did it. She never visited. She thought it was like a terrible place. She based it on Coronation Street, which I loved growing up. But yes, yeah, so my dad and my mum met very young and started a family, really. So they had my brother 3 years later, my sister. So by the time they were 29, they had three children. And my dad, because this is, you know, the mental health thing. So my dad, when I was growing up, until the age of 11, my dad was very much, he would disappear. But I didn't really know why, but he would disappear for weeks on end. But it was always very fractious and sort of frightening, really. And I didn't think he'd gone on holiday, and I didn't think he'd gone somewhere for work. You knew he'd sort of gone off, you know. And so he would come back and often be in bed and things like that. But then he would always come back. So when I was 11, my dad, it was really high unemployment. If people haven't watched the Adam Curtis Shifty, it's on iPlayer. It's so brilliant about the 80s and sort of leading into the 80s and the, you know, what Britain was like and the decimation of Britain. So my dad was unemployed, and then he'd got this job which came with a company car. It's disputed in the family. I always remember he was a Singer sewing machine salesman, but my mum, who I never ever talked to about what happened, told my brother he was a hairdryer salesman. Anyway, I don't know, but he'd got a new car, and I was very excited about this new car and being driven to school, and he drove me to school, and then we never saw him again. And he drove off to we just didn't know for like about 5 or 6 days. But the thing was, because he'd always come back, I was in this incredibly I was 11, I was fourth year junior school, and I was in this incredibly kind of I don't know, where I wanted to cheer everyone up. And because he'd always come back before, I remember coming back home after school one day, and my mum and sister were crying, and I was like, no, he's coming back, you know, he always does, and all that. And then he didn't. So it was a shattering on that level. And so it was that kind of, dreadful knock on the... My mum was sleeping in my single bed because she was, like, relying on me. And the door went, and I remember going to the top. My sister and my brother were at the landing there, and the police came. And when I look back, they were about 19. They were so young, and they had to deliver this news. But they didn't really deliver it. My mum stepped back and went, no, no, no. And then I knew that was it.
Right.
Yeah, but then the unraveling happened, because everybody and everything fell apart. And actually, even though my dad was whatever he had, which was never really... diagnosed, whatever it was, the sort of family held together somehow through it. But once he was gone, it was like my mum just sort of rejected society, you know, so it was bedlam. And we, and my brother at that time was 20, so the house got taken over by punks, so it was 77. So we had a punk band in the back called Manicured Noise, rather good. And I remember, I do remember walking in the back room. So I was about 11. Yeah, I was about 11. There was like a threesome going on with a whip and stuff like that. So honestly, and then in the front room, there was a Holiday in the Sun poster and people used to come and sign it. And so the house, you know, my dad was very strict. And so suddenly it became like anarchy, literally anarchy. So so it was a very different time from the time before. Yeah.
But I remember you saying, you know, that you were sort of kept away from quite a lot of the information, and you being the detective superintendent that you are, found out.
Well, I mean, I think it was, I overheard. So we didn't have any family nearby. My sister said, get the neighbour, because she was the doctor's receptionist, right? So the police went and got the doctor's receptionist, because it was like, so she came in and my mum said to her about the carbon monoxide poisoning, or that he'd done it in the car with a hose pipe or something. And that's how I knew that bit. But it was literally listening. But I didn't go to the funeral because my mum thought I was too young. And also the funeral wasn't in Manchester or Stockport. It was actually held where he killed himself, which was some unfathomable reason was in Slough. Yeah. And so it was too expensive to bring the body back. So he was cremated there. So I never went to that. And in fact, in that photo you showed before, Colette, that was cut out of the photo, I re-met her recently, and I went to stay with her at that time. So she was remembering stuff about that time. But it was so, over the years, it became very much a kind of trying to piece it together. There were no photos of him around the house, and no one ever talked about him. It was like, you don't talk about it. No one ever talked about it.
Yeah.
Him or it, the situation.
If I'm not wrong, did you not find a suicide note?
So when I was about, so we moved to a flat and it was just me and my mum. And I remember my mum had like one orange dress. And when it was the funeral, she got a navy dress and a clutch bag, which I've never forgotten that bag. And it was always hung in her wardrobe. She didn't wear it again, but the bag was in there. And one day I went and looked in the bag, and the death certificate was in, and that's when I knew about this carbon monoxide poisoning, which I looked up each word in, well, carbon and monoxide in the dictionary, and that was in there, and a photocopy of his suicide note, which didn't mention me or my sister or brother, which I was annoyed about. But yeah, so that was another piece, but it was gradually piecing it together.
So I mean, I know that, you know, this is a big subject, and it had, as it would do with anyone, it had huge repercussions for you. And I always look at this photo and I see this is a very telling photo.
And also I've got pen on my face.
I didn't want to
say that.
They
could have told me that when I had my photo taken.
I never mind. We're not saying it. But basically, you know, in the next year, things picked up in the sense of you went, right, okay, I'm going to sort things out a little bit on my own. And I think one of the things, if I'm not wrong, there was an element of self-medication that came along.
Well, I mean, it sort of over time, but so not long after that, I got very, very drunk with my friend Anne. I remember we went into Mersey Square and we got these older guys to buy us sherry and wine, which was, and we, oh yeah, well done. And we mixed it in these cans. And I just remember being in Mersey Square just so, so drunk. I mean, I don't think I've ever, I mean, I probably have been drunk, but at that age, it was a new experience. And you know, it was just bedlam. And then so it's a bit older than that photo you just showed. And they wouldn't let me on the bus and they called an ambulance. And then we went back to Anne's house. And in the morning, I remember Tiz was on. I was sleeping on the couch and I'd been sick on her mum's cardigan. And and I had love bites on my neck, which we couldn't work out where they were from. But anyway, but then I didn't actually drink for because it was such an off-putting experience. I didn't drink until I was 16. All my friends were drinking cider and stuff. And so I started drinking again when the Hacienda nightclub opened. And it formed the basis of when I was writing up the thing for the alcohol years to try and get money. And I said, it was true. I said, I started the week off on Pernod and Black and ended it on whiskey, neat whiskey. And that's what happened. And then I never looked back. Just drunk almost entirety of Welsh
well,
pop.
Yes. Well, okay. Well, I had thought that there'd been a little bit of an excursion before that because I thought the interesting, very interesting thing about your story is how you did investigate the Pernod and Black department.
Yeah, briefly.
But also that you worked in a bookshop.
Well, I worked in the bookshop when I was 15 and I would nick off school. I would take the day off school on a Friday and work in the bookshop. Yeah.
And you got paid in books?
Well, yeah, because she would run out of money, Christine, that ran it. But it was like the biggest selling books were the men came in for the Westerns, the women for the Mills and Boons. And then there was some literary classics at the front, which I would take. Well, no, she would, you know, I'd either buy them with my wages or she would give me extras.
Right.
So that's when I was like reading.
This is a bookshop. It's not the bookshop.
That isn't, because it was actually called the bookshop.
Yeah. I've had a go.
It had in the back room, it had a big porn collection as well. But you had to get
the
brown paper bag brigade. Right. Yeah.
And this is when you changed a bit. And and this is the sort of books that you were reading.
I remember being really into Samuel Beckett. I read Molloy, Malone and the Unnameable, and I couldn't say anything about it now, but at the time I was so deeply involved in Samuel Beckett. It just meant everything.
Well, it's unusual for someone who's 15 to be into that, but you like Thomas Hardy.
Yeah, I read Thomas Hardy definitely, and D.H. Lawrence, and like Violet Le Duc as well. Lots of French, like Colette, lots of French writers, obviously translated, because I couldn't speak a word of French. But
right.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so I've probably got my, you know, I can't believe I got my facts wrong. And,
but I've probably misinformed you.
Well, it's quite, I'll talk to my lawyers and you talk to yours. But what I always thought was interesting, again, was that you were at school at this point and, you know, up to 16. And yet you made a film which got The Falling, and that was, and I wondered whether you when you're making that film, we're going to show a clip because it's so weird. It is so weird, this clip, but I like it.
Can't wait.
And, you know, whether you thought at the time, my school in Stockport. I mean, they're very different schools, I think. But
well, what was interesting though is because some people think it's a boarding school, some people don't. But I was on Twitter at the time when the film came out, and people that didn't know I'd gone to Goyent Bank, it reminded them of the school I'd gone to, Goyent Bank Comprehensive, which was full of asbestos and falling apart. It had buckets everywhere, and in fact, that forms the basis of the film as well. The idea that you could be poisoned in a school.
Right. Should we watch it?
Yeah.
Stand by.
I don't know what clip you got, so I'm excited.
Here we go.
Sit. Stand. Silence in the corridors and the communal areas. Skirts no more than 2 inches from the ground when kneeling.
If I were a fly on the wall in your house, what would I see?
You're quite an influence on the others. Fraternize with any of these girls.
Who was the first person in your age group to show symptoms?
You all know something is wrong. We're not kids anymore, love.
Have you had sexual intercourse?
Close your eyes, kiss your lips. I will not tolerate such conduct.
Crazy witches!
The standards of behavior must be kept. This is a school, it's not a mental institution.
Oh, I can't you!
I'm not mad.
All secrets rise to the surface.
You're dangerous.
Nobody knows who I am anymore. What I'm really like. What I think about doing.
great. I love that. I think it's
I've got two of the cast here.
Nine star weird, you know. But I was very pleased because I had thought to myself, references to Picnic at Hanging Rock, an Australian film. And also I thought, what about If? Lindsay Anderson. And then I read Mr. Commode, and he went, and he'd written that, and I went, oh God, that's
what I thought. But I think when he Mark Commode wrote, I didn't know his references that he thought right. It inspired me.
Yeah.
So what had inspired me was definitely Picnic at Hanging Rock, Peter Weir, and If.
Interesting. And you had Florence Pugh, because it has to have some. That's great that you did that. I mean,
so Florence was at school in Oxfordshire, and our casting agent had said to me and Quira, cast locally in where the school was in Oxfordshire, cast locally because you won't have to put any of the girls up in a hotel, so it'd be cheaper. And Florence was at school, and I watched hundreds of videotapes of girls from the Oxfordshire area, and actually one of the last ones I watched was Florence's, and she'd never done anything before. She'd never been in a film.
Yeah.
And when I saw her, I was like, could you take your makeup off? She was 17. She went to take her makeup off, and she was absolutely. I didn't get anyone to read from the film any parts or anything. I got them, the young women, to tell stories about objects I brought in, and she was captivating. And when she left the room, the casting associates were really quiet, and I'm like, do you not think she's absolutely amazing? And they went, we've got goosebumps. That was like discovering a young Kate Winslet. So she already had, and what all I was doing really was I'd written a part where there was one girl that brought down an entire school and took them into mass psychogenic illness or mass hysteria. And I needed someone really powerful, but that wasn't aware of it and wasn't too sophisticated. And that was Florence at the time, because she's very sophisticated now. But and then actually in there, there's you see Maxine Peake's character Eileen a little bit, and I'd based Eileen on my auntie Sally, who would do hairdressing from home with like a can of hairspray and a fag in her mouth, which was, you know, so flammable, but it always remained in my head, and I was a bit worried about her seeing it, because I thought, but she went to see it with my cousins in Colwyn Bay, and apparently at the end she was telling everyone it was her. Maxine Peake played me, which was really fun. And so I think there is an inevitability that you are going to draw from life experience, and I'm certainly, because of my own life experience, definitely attracted to the darker side of life, although I feel like a responsibility to everybody and also myself to bring the light to it. I'm not interested in grim is not my thing.
Right, okay, let's move on. So basically 16, you decided to go to the University of Hacienda.
Oh yeah.
And
I don't think I decided, I was just sort of woke up there.
You just woke up there, okay. And you dived into the deep end.
Yeah.
And if anyone doesn't understand what the Hacienda was the biggest club in the north, virtually.
Even Europe. We would say it was the biggest club in Europe.
Yeah, okay. Owned by the chap who owned Factory Records.
Well, and New Order ploughed all their money into it.
Did they?
Well, I remember asking Pete Hook once. He was about 25. I thought he was ancient. And I said, Hookie, when are you going to make your first million? He said, I already did, but it's gone into the Hacienda. And we've lost it.
Okay. We've got a picture of him in a minute with your brother.
Yeah.
Apparently, I probably got this wrong, that you'd never liked Pernod Black.
No, I did. I started the week on Pernod Black.
Okay. So basically, this period is very difficult to sum up quickly. I mean, you lasted here 4 years, which is a long, long time.
Yeah, so it's really this period, my Hacienda period was, and why the film is called The Alcohol Years, was really an alcohol-fueled period. I left in 86, 87, and at that point, the drugs took over, the ecstasy and everything else. My period was speed, alcohol and acid. And then the big drugs came in, the big mafia of drugs, and then there were guns, but I left before the gun period.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, it's fairly safe, really, apart from the men.
Yes,
apart from that. Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's good. Well, here's a picture. Look, you see that? If you look up there, you'll see.
Oh, okay. That is my brother. So when my dad died, I was 11 and my brother was 20. And he at that point left for London and started writing for the New Musical Express. So I don't know where he is here exactly, but he would visit now and again. That? Oh, that's him. But, yeah. And that's Hooky with very long hair.
Yeah. Wow.
And Tony Wilson,
that's Madonna as well. And that's
so Madonna danced on the Hacienda dance floor, and the barman there from the cocktail bar, she offered him her bra, and he didn't want it. He said, "Who? What? She's nobody." That's how arrogant everybody was Manchester. Yeah.
But I mean, I know from that book that you had a lot of friends, intimate friends, shall we say, that you were zooming around. And I mean, to me, without trying to be an analyst, that you were wanting to be loved and wanting to belong to something. What do you think?
Yeah, I've never quite figured it out, because it coincided, like you say, it coincided with the years. Well, I was 16, not 18, but you would sort of go to university or college and maybe have that experimentation in your life and all of that. There was not a lot of, everybody was on the dole. Nobody had any money. Everybody was scavenging, basically. And so, but the people, it seemed like there was a high population within the Hacienda that were being on top of the pops. It was really weird. Like, Manchester had this very significant musical history and people were in bands. So when I left school at 16, it was very much like, I'll be in a band, because that's how you can make money. At school, which is in the book, the careers teacher said, if you work hard, you won't get, if you work hard, you might get a job. It won't be a job you want, but you might get a job. I mean, there was very little aspiration.
Yeah.
And so, but the music, so you were in the Hacienda with New Order, or, you know, like, see, some of Susie and the Banshees would come down. But in fact, what was quite funny is that A Certain Ratio, who were a brilliant Manchester band, they were on the front of the NME. And the next week, their dole got cut because the dole officers had seen them on the front of the NME. You know, because everyone was like on top of the pops, but still signing on, you know, still getting unemployment benefit. But it was a fascinating time, a brilliant time. But at 16, you're entering into that. There's a lot of older men.
Yeah.
And so when I look back, I think if I had a daughter of that age, I wouldn't let her out. But at the same time, it was definitely experiencing life at full frontal.
But in some ways, you said it's, you know, you could have gone to university and had the same experience as people do, bonking their way around and everything, and lots of drugs and drink. Yeah. But it was very extreme, because, I mean, you know, you could have actually kept going and not kept going. I mean, without being, dramatic. I mean, you certainly went on to, like, you were drinking lots of whiskey and stuff like that.
Neat. It was like Jameson's neat. But also the cocktail bar, I never bought a drink. They would give me a bottle of whiskey. And in the cocktail bar, they did Death in the Afternoons, which it was from Hemingway, wasn't it? But it was all very, a bit literary and a bit, but it was very, very extremely alcoholic. So you carried out of the nightclub somewhere.
Yeah, Well, I mean, sad to have, you know, like Ian Curtis, from Joy Division. I always thought that was a very sad story. Not the same thing at all, I know. But the good news is that you suddenly went bing. I think it was that note, actually. It was a C major, I think it was. And you went, right, I have got to stop this, and I'm going to London. And you went to London.
I mean, it wasn't as simple as that, but let's pretend it was.
Make it more complicated.
No, I ended up in Devon, in Newton Abbot, working in a factory from 3 till 11 and sometimes 3 to 2 in the morning. And it was where, in the olden days, people used to send their films away to be developed in packages. And you used to have to write your name twice, name and address twice, once on the edge and once on it. And I used to open the envelope, put a number on the film and then a number on the envelope so they could be matched the prints later, and put it on a rack, and I had to do 100 an hour. and I was there for 6 months, and then one day I just started crying and I couldn't go back. So it was like, but it was this weird thing where I was an automaton. And then I did go to London. That was pretty disastrous, and I probably left again, and then eventually I went back. So it was all over the place, really.
I've got the romantic story.
Well, it's just simpler, isn't it? I don't think my friend. I have friends here. They don't know any of this. So
okay. I
could see Leanne's face then going, oh, you worked in a photo factory. But it was very complicated. But what happened was there was a certain point where I just thought I was about 23 and living in London doing loads of different jobs. I worked for an industrial agency, which meant you could get work with no qualifications because I had no qualifications. So I worked for this industrial agency and did all kinds of jobs that were very interesting in their own way. But I just had, you know, I just wanted something else. And I saw an advert somewhere. I don't know if it was Loot or the Evening Standard, but it was for a part-time photo video course in the East End in Whitechapel at Tamlets College and an evening class in film studies, A-level. And you did an A-level photography. And I didn't have any experience, but that week I lived in a bit of a squat and I bought a dark room from Loot, if anyone remembers the classified ads in Loot. And I bought a dark room from a widow and set it up with a library book in the kitchen. And in that week, learnt to print some photos. And then I went to this interview for this part-time course in Tower Hamlets. So that changed my life. And the teacher there is a brilliant filmmaker and writer in her own right, Bev Zorcock. She taught the A-level at night and she changed my life. She wore a denim jacket with Sid Vicious on it. I'm like, this is a brilliant teacher.
And was she the one who led you to St. Martin's?
Well, really then you applied to various places, but I just really wanted to go to art college, but I applied to other places and that's where I went. And then I would say education and brilliant teachers, and that's what changed my life, definitely. Well, changed my life or just certainly put me on a different course. That I'm glad.
Okay.
Sometimes.
No,
filmmaking's brilliant.
So, here's one of the things, and you know, maybe you could talk about that and see what you think about
making my bed. Okay.
I think we've hit on something.
I think that I do. While I find I need a routine, it's quite difficult because doing what I do, it could be easy to slip out of a routine because so much of it is self-motivated and sort of having to kind of put ideas in front of people and all of that. So I always think nobody really wants what I'm doing. I have to make them. Me and Cairo Keller, we have to make them and want it. So it's sort of, but I do set a routine. And once I turned about 50 or something, I learned to swim, which was really hard, but I did it. And that was really helpful. One, to know that I could take on that sort of challenge and fear. But also when I swim, I can't think of anything else because it's so complicated for me to swim. So I feel that swimming becomes a meditation.
Yes, I
do think it's really important. My last film I made, Type Your Star, is Pirate King, Monica Dolan starring as Audrey Amos. That took me into research into severe mental health. So I'd always been surrounded by, and myself included, mental health that maybe gets medicated, but I hadn't necessarily, apart from my auntie, actually one auntie, I hadn't really been surrounded by psychosis and extreme mental health. And I think with that, with researching that, I became very mindful of how we even define what reality is. But interestingly enough, Audrey Amos, who died at 79, having been diagnosed at 24 with paranoid schizophrenia, she'd kept so many diaries. I was able to understand how she lived her daily life, especially as an older person. And she would go for walks, and she definitely believed in a routine, and she would have a routine. Yeah. And she also, because she trained as an artist, a painter at the Royal Academy, and to the day she died, she kept up her sketching. She used to say she was Toulouse-Lautrec on legs in the local area of Clapham. But she knew the importance. So she came off medication, she went back on, she was in and out of it. But she definitely almost taught me, in a way, reading her diaries, the importance of a routine, to feel grounded, in a way.
But and seeing the relationship with the creative,
And Audrey knew that that was, you know, an important part of her keeping in the world. But I think all my sort of research, because I got a welcome screenwriting fellowship, I think that really made me very conscious that ideas of cognitive ideas of what is fact, what is fiction, what is real and what is not are so highly debatable that I'm very careful really in my life not to assume anyone sees what I see or that we function in similar ways. So yeah. I feel for me it's like, I think what you've done though with that is really interesting, because I think that could probably be hard, you know, taken by people in all different ways. So it's good.
I think it's good in the sense that it's good for people to understand it without it being overwhelming. And, you know, these days there's a lot of stuff on mental health that goes out, which is a bit, my own view is slightly a little bit too much. And it's how you do it, it's how you say it, you know. And for instance, let's, you know, keep on track. I mean, you know, anger is, again, you know, people don't think about it really. They go, oh, you know, so bloody angry, that bastard, you know. And, you know, anger, if you don't express anger...
Anger is an energy. That's the Sex Pistols, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, okay, but if you don't express it, in other words, whack a tennis racket on the floor or whatever it is, thing, you know, punch ball, it will, and you suppress it, it will turn into a depression. And that's what, you know, the things like that. I mean, I don't know whether you're someone who's...
Well, I don't know, but I would say definitely, because I really love when I meet like my younger relatives that they are able to talk about mental health in a way that I can't even do now particularly. And they talk about it like and using terms that I would have found really embarrassing. And when my dad died, it was terribly embarrassing. That's why we never talked about it. To kill yourself was an embarrassment to those left behind. So I feel like the more people do express things in a way that makes them part of everyday life is really, really important. And with my dad coming from like being born in the 30s and living through a particular time in Britain, it was a very repressed time, you know. And when he, my mum, you know, when they had to get married, obviously they were, my mum got pregnant, but they had to get married. So it was a very sort of forced adulthood. Mm. And when I look at a 19-year-old now, I see them as so little, you know, and kind of unformed. But that was the age they were, and they had to take on such responsibility. But that was generational. And so I think that probably, you know, obviously mental illnesses do arise from not being able to be yourself or express yourself, I'm sure.
Yes, yeah. I think that's true. Do three things you don't want to do. Do you find that difficult? Yeah.
This. No, I'm only joking.
But outrageous.
I do feel slightly. You know, because the natural reaction would be to go, oh my God, do I really want to talk about everything in front of people? So it would be, you know, but I feel like it's good to do things. So I always, like, in my 30s, I don't think I publicly spoke till I was in my late 30s. I had a fear of public speaking. I got over that because it was hampering my life. So I think...
swimming.
I think doing things... Yeah, swimming, I was frightened. So I think doing things that you don't want to do is really... I think it is really important to sort of proving to yourself that you can, you know, be active in the world.
Well, that's just what it's all about, the self-esteem department.
The third thing will be dancing, because I've always been slightly weird about dancing, so... And I think that's actually why...
I saw you on Strictly.
But that's what... I think that's why I actually drank so much at the Hacienda, so I didn't have to dance, you know, so it's like...
Well, you did.
Loads to... No, I didn't. It was like loads of drinking round the back on the canal.
Yeah. anyway... But, you know, what I like about you is that you have funny taste, and you go, you know, from liking terribly intellectual things to this.
So, yeah, this is brilliant.
You know, Holmes Under the Hammer, and that's just extremely important.
Well, also, Holmes Under the Hammer gives this absolutely brilliant insight into the North-South divide, because you're looking at some basement flat in London that's mouldy with a really weird access into it for like 750 to a million. And then you go up north and you're in like Stoke-on-Trent or Derby and they're like 50,000 for a house with a garden. And if you go to Wales... Wow, you know, parts of Wales. So I love Homes Under the Hammer, but also for me, I just love the transformations that people make. I just found it beautiful.
That's good, relaxing. Yeah, it's relaxing. Look, that's someone swimming.
That is me. So that is because, like, that is me in a rash suit, because I'm like, a bit like I don't want to get burnt. That was on holiday. That is not an all-over tattoo. And also, I had pictures, not with a rash suit on, but I wasn't giving you them. So that's my, that's my for the public consumption.
That's very, very annoying. You said to me once that you both had pets, but they were all imaginary.
Me and Kyra only have imaginary pets. And can I just tell you this? So because I wear glasses, I also, when I wear goggles, they're prescription goggles.
Yes.
So they're prescription goggles. And I'm always knocking my glasses off the side of the bed. So I wake up in the morning and I can't see. Right. And I'm like looking under the bed. And one day I couldn't find my glasses, but I managed to find my prescription goggles. So I put them on going around the bedroom looking for my glasses, which I found deep under the bed. Anyway, so they're very, very useful.
Okay.
That's
essential. Yeah. Anyway, I've decided you're not going to have imaginary pets anymore, and I've got these.
Have you got me a kitten?
Yeah, I've got your black kitten and a Labrador in there.
Well, you see, imaginary pets are perfect because they can, you don't have to like look after them, but you can have the same sense of personality to them.
Well, I think, you know, what this is all about, isn't it? It's how to stay sane in an insane world, and we've got to come up with our own things, and you come up with, you know, quite a few good things, I think. And you know, I think also that the whole idea of art, the whole idea of creativity being a balm for mental health, I think is really important. And I think you've proved that, whether unconsciously and just gone and done it. And, you know, hello, I don't know. Anyway, but this is a very interesting thing we were talking about only 1 minute ago, but we're speeding on because we've got a bit of a time thing.
I'll be writing a letter of complaint about your late arrival.
Yeah, you too. The Queen.
That's more like it.
Any changes we should be aware of?
Your appearance has slipped to an all-time low.
This stuff.
That's my art. I used to be in the kitchen sink school of realism, but now I'm avant-garde and misunderstood.
Yeah.
You need to drive myself and my art to this gallery before the deadline.
Must be close by now.
It is 280 miles precisely. Sunderland.
You said it was local.
It is to me. Well, let's get a move on, heave ho.
I'm king of everything!
Come in, Louise, eh? I think you need to see Dorothy. Your sister.
Oh, she'd love that, Dorothy would. Me turning up with my psychiatric nurse.
Oh, Audrey. Do you know what's funny? You've got me thinking in pictures now.
That's your aura?
Somehow, you know, that's the way I feel inside.
Audrey!
Hello. I'm seeing you, Audrey.
I believed I was going to achieve recognition.
You had such an exceptional gift for art, Audrey.
I'd like to buy more of your work.
Vincent van Gogh only sold one painting in his lifetime. I've outdone him. The world is crying out for more magic.
Art makes life worth living.
I'm glad I came with you.
You must be bonkers.
That's great.
Oh, that's
nice. I love that. I think it's really great.
Monica Dolan.
Really good.
We have Audrey Amis here. Well, Monica Dolan, who played Audrey.
Brilliant. Really good to see you. And
oh, I like this.
This is
I'll
a nice
bit. I'll just exit around there.
Yeah, that's right. No, well, you know, annoyingly, you know, if we had another half an hour, we could do lots. But, you know, you are a courageous person and funny, which I like.
I agree and, with funny.
And I think it's... but I think, you know, a lot of this is, you know, you have to have some courage. And, you know, and people who get... You get stuck in mental health stuff, you know, it's not all, you know, comatose and it's not raging, you know, but you do have to get on and take the action and sort yourself out and build your little routine and build your little toolbox and all that thing, however trite that can sound. And, you know, you make the sort of films that are interesting, you know, and that are about, you know, that are about people. And what can I say but thank you? You are totally tip-top and tidy. And thank you very much, Carol.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Jeremy. I actually find it really hard to say the name Jeremy. Jeremy.
You must practice. Right, now we now go to the section of the show where we're going to do questions and answers.
Yeah, I forgot that bit.
Normally when we do this, no, there isn't normally, so I've not done it before, we would have a roving mic, but because it's actually quite an intimate cinema, just be very, very brave and go, hello, my name is Nigel No Mate, and I would like to ask Carol a question, and it is. Ready? Okay, so who has got a question? Please come and say, I will come up and deal with you. Just stand up and do it. I know it's brave. I know you can do it.
Ooh. Well, Jeremy, I'll ask a question. It's completely apropos of nothing, really. But you were talking about pets quite recently. And yeah. I did hear that goldfish or a fish in a tank is a very good and relaxing way, even looking at a photograph of a fish in a tank can do that. Is that something you've come across at all?
Well, you have to say that if you go to the dentist and you're about to be tortured, you know, that they always have a fish tank there, don't they?
Yeah.
I mean, there is something very good about fish and fish tank, you know, because you can just watch them and it's very nice. I'm going for that.
Yeah, I think that it's probably quite hypnotic, isn't it? But it's live, but you don't have to look after it too much.
Well, that's what I've heard.
Yeah.
And even looking at a photograph of a fish in a fish tank.
Yeah, I don't know whether I'd go on the photograph, but I think I think if you have two fish in a bowl, and Norman and Nobby, you know, they're your mates, pets, aren't they? Then it's something. You know, it sounds ridiculous, but you know, if you think. Half the problem for a lot of people is being alone and not having anything in their life, you know. And I say, why not? Why can't you say that? Yes, thank you very much. I know that your name is Jenny, and thank you very much, Jenny. A marvellous question. Next question, please.
Hi, I'm Charlie. I've got a question.
Hi, Charlie.
Firstly, Carol, thank you, and thanks, Jeremy. I really, I'm sorry to hear about your dad taking his own life. And actually, on my dad's side of the family, there's quite a lot of that. You know, great uncles shooting themselves, and and also sort of tragedy, car crashes, stuff like that. And it's interesting because when I was young, like you, the names were never, ever mentioned.
Yeah.
They were just not mentioned. You just never heard about DH. You never heard about Sophia. You never heard about these people. And now that the grown-ups are getting older, like between 70 and 90, yeah, we are hearing those names mentioned at holiday, you know, high days and, you know, the odd sort of wedding or whatever. The names come out. So something has changed, but I'm not sure what. Do you have any views on that?
Well, I think there is just more talked about. And I would say that, you know, as I've gone through life, you know, like even a soap opera taking on a theme, you know, to do with whether it be sexuality or suicide. So I think popular culture is very important in embracing these things. I mean, like when they did the Olympics, Danny Ball, and they put in the first lesbian kiss on Brookside, wasn't there? And those were like momentous times of before it hadn't been included in popular culture. So I think popular culture has a really important part to play.
I think there is something, which is that when COVID happened, although COVID was responsible for a lot of poor mental health, you know, and triggering it, it was also ironically responsible for giving people permission to talk about it. And I think that gained momentum, not to a perverted degree, but, you know, people were going, well, actually, my dad committed suicide.
Yeah.
You know, it was okay. And I think that changed quite a few things. And I think it's good. I'm not saying that, you know, you make it the topic of the breakfast, but I mean, you know, it is good that people can say things. And because, I mean, just on that very basis of, God, really? Because it's just happened to my friend, you know. And as you say, popular culture. Yeah, is that an answer?
Thank you. Charlie? Perfect.
Thank you very much. Next question, please.
There's some over here. There's two there. I don't know.
Where are they? Go for it.
I've got a question. Okay. The alcohol years. Hi, Caroline Beckett. I bought the DVD when you were talking Waterstones a few years ago, and I kind of put it in to watch it, and I had to turn it off because I found it really triggering for my alcohol years. And I just wondered what you thought when you were making the film, how you what was your emotional journey with it to go back and talk to people or hear these stories about yourself? Like, how did you cope with that?
Well, I with the alcohol years, which you're all about to see, so I can't believe it was made 25 years ago. And at that point, it was going back and I felt really old. It was like, and at the time, the alcohol years, I was 16 to 21 and I felt really old at 16 to 21. It's crazy. But it really was like I wouldn't have been the person that would go to a school reunion or ever venture back into those times. And the reason I did it was because I had a camera. And that was my the camera protected me. And also it made me feel very constructive. I think that's the right word. And I remember when me and Cara Keller, the producer, when we showed it in Manchester to the Manchester people that had been in it, one guy went, "Oh my God, I wouldn't have been in it if I knew you were gonna finish it." Because people genuinely didn't think I could get that far. Doing those interviews was really fascinating because I felt like I don't want to say too much about the film because it's for you to come to your conclusions or interpretations. But it did feel as though in seeking this kind of lost memories or fragments that it became very revealing about the people themselves. And so it became very, very, it was so constructive that if someone said something about how much they hated me, inside I was cheering because I knew it would be good for the film because every film needs conflict. Whereas in real life, if someone said that, you'd be like, you know, a bit devastated or upset. But because it was making this, you know, film out of it, everything felt very useful. But I did have kind of weird dreams and stuff like that, and it was hard, but it wasn't even therapy, but it was the sense of definitely making something out of a very messy time. Now, I never wanted my mum to see it, and she was living in Wales, and that was Welsh Channel 4, and I asked, does it go out on Welsh Channel 4? They said no. But apparently it went out half an hour later. My mum watched it and we had some friends around to watch it on telly because like, oh, it's on telly, you know, it's on Channel 4. And about half an hour later, the phone rang and it was my mum. And I'm like, oh my God, she's going to be so like, oh, I didn't know. Are you okay? All this. And she went, somebody in the film said I was disorganized. And you're like, and you're sort of like, oh, okay. And that was, you know, so it was interesting because I think the thing I was most worried about was putting it out there. But it was actually no, people only sort of notice themselves or their own bits, and I don't know, but yeah, so it was an interesting, and it was it became very difficult in the edit, I think, because I feel that was like really coming to terms with it, and it would be things like show it at film festival in Cork or something, and the first person to come up to me would go, do you want a shag? You know what I mean? Because you're putting it out there. And then I'd go, I went to Russia, to St. Petersburg, to a festival, met all these really new friends. So you actually have stayed in touch with, and you're like trying to present this good side of yourself. And then they go and see your film straight away almost. And then you're like, oh God, you know. But what was really interesting, like there was, after the alcohol years, I remember after it was on telly, going to the dentist, and the dental receptionist, who was in her 60s, she opened the door and she was, you know, she was just like, absolutely, I'd never really thought about her life. And she opened the door and she went, I was the slag as well. And then it just made me really happy to have put that film out there, because it's sort of, you're like, oh my God, you know, people are, you know, that live in the home counties are relating to it. It's not just about you went to Manchester. The film actually did really well as well in Australia, and particularly it was shown at the Melbourne Film Festival, and people really related to it in a culturally similar way. But it did reach out, but yeah, it's a bit of a weird calling card, you know, like, but then I know that it's a construct, it's all constructed, and so for me the beauty and the brilliance of documentary is when it is a contradictory and shows conflict, and I don't really warm to ones that want to reach one opinion. And just to say one more thing about the alcohol years, it was really, really important that for me that I didn't demonize anyone in it, because the people that come forward to be in a documentary are the bravest of all, because you can edit them in different ways. So I just feel it's a real tribute to everyone that appeared in it and gave themselves to the film. And so I was very touched by that, actually, and how articulate everyone was. But yeah, it was a mad, you know, kind of woo time.
Very good.
Yeah.
Next.
There was a question.
Hi, Carol.
Yeah. Hi.
My name's Donna. I was wondering if you could identify one part of your filmmaking career you find particularly grueling emotionally.
Say that last bit.
Just particularly emotionally grueling.
One particular part of it.
Yeah, and how you got through it.
I think it's all really grueling. I think the thing is, I think there's different. You see, because making the film is the best part, because you're actually making the film and you're in the under the conditions where, even though they're really hard and you maybe not got the right amount of light for the day, and somebody's got COVID or somebody's had a heart attack, which has happened to us, or, you know, a studio roof has fallen down, all this kind of stuff. Even though that's going on, you're making the film, and it's just, you survive it, and it's really energizing, and you just get through it. I think the worst part is trying to get the money and trying to convince people to come on board. And I think that is so difficult, because you also have to acknowledge to yourself that you're not special. You don't deserve this small amount of money that's in there. You don't deserve it. But you kind of, you know, I know inside of me that I have these stories that are very important for me to tell. And so that I find very, very hard. And I think the thing that probably gets me down the most, because I want to be actively telling and making those stories, but I'm also don't just want to work. I want to tell the stories in a particular way. So I think that's really, really hard. And then I think when the film comes out, like a bad review is really exciting, because someone is critically engaged with your work and hates it, but it means it exists. So that I don't mind that. I feel the writing process, I've written now a few feature films, and I find that really, really hard to be in your own kind of space and not really sure if what you're doing is any good, which it generally isn't, you know what I mean? Because I think screenwriting is all about rewriting. So it's that first showing of your screenplay to someone is really hard. So I think it's encountering, for me, the difficult things are encountering people that aren't like-minded and don't want to make my films. but with Dreams of a Life, which it got turned down so many times, I wrote letters, and one of the letters was like, it got taken back to the panel to reconsider, and then they turned it down again. But I'm proud of those letters. I'm proud because I knew that we shouldn't give up with it, you know. So, but and I think with Audrey Amos researching Typist Artist Pirate King, I really sort of began to feel like I knew Audrey. And then I met all the family. Audrey was, you know, deceased, but I met all the family and I felt a lot of weight and responsibility towards the family. So there's different elements, but most of all, it's not getting something made. It's heartbreaking, really.
Great. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. That's well, the heartbreak.
What you could say about you, though, is that you, in my dials, is that the resilience one, you've got quite yeah. high reading.
Well, I think in my book, if I remember rightly, I think the last line is about without, I know it sounds really weird, and I'm not being Pollyanna, but without my dad killing himself, I wouldn't be a filmmaker. I think he turned me into a filmmaker in a way, or someone that wanted to investigate and get under the kind of, under the sort of, go into the depths of what it is to live. And so his death made me definitely want to understand what it is to live and to die and what it is to be human. And I think he did do that. And I think that gives me a lot of kind of, sort of, it makes me feel better about what happened, because I think otherwise it's just so destructive. So I feel like for everybody that, and most people do experience some kind of, as you were saying before, trauma, and for me, trauma is something that comes out of the blue, you know, that you don't expect. And I feel to cope with that is very, very, you know, it's very sort of discombobulating. But I feel like sometimes the trauma itself can transform you. And I feel it's that transformative process, like can happen in grief or can happen in situations, that makes us human beings and can take us forward in our lives. And
I think that's really, really true. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, we've come to the end of this section. What's going to happen now is we're going to move a lot of the equipment up there. If you would like to visit the bar, the ladies, the gents, please do so at high speed and then come back, because in about 5 or so minutes we're going to show the alcohol years. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Hooray.